So for this evening's Dhamma talk, I'm going to try to do something very difficult. I'm going to try to do a short and simple talk on dependent origination. So it's a challenge, all right? So bear with me if I don't succeed. As we sit here right now, we look inside, and what do we see? Really look inside. What is there? What am I? And this is the basic question underlying all of the deeper spiritual practices. And one of the most startling and in some ways unexpected things that we find when we look inside is that we ask, well, what is this? What's going on? What is this I that I seem to be seeing or that I talk about? And we look inside and we don't know. What is that? Actually, what am I doing? Where do my thoughts come from? Why do I feel like this? How did I get born in this place? How long have I been? What does the word I even mean? All of these kinds of questions, which would surely seem to be very obvious. You know, we can look at simple objects in the world. We can look at a cup or a car or something, and we can answer these kinds of questions. Where do they come from? What purpose do they have? Why are they like that? Why are they not like another way? And we can give sensible answers to those things. But when we look in our own minds, where we would surely should be the most intimate, the most experienced, we really don't know those things. So this is that truth that the Buddha was pointing to when he talked about avidya and ignorance. We really don't know about ourselves, about the answers to those profound and important questions in our life. And the depth of our unknowing is measured by the lengths that we go to know. The effort that's put into understanding the world, understanding the self, understanding oneself, all the psychology and the philosophy and the science and all of these kinds of things that we try to do to fill this gap of unknowing. And yet we do all of those things and the gap doesn't disappear. It may lessen, and usually does, you know, as life goes on, as we have experiences, we learn about ourselves and so on. We usually, as one gets older, one comes to a better understanding of oneself and sort of the ignorance diminishes at least a little bit. And you're more kind of comfortable with that. So it's out of this ignorance that we act, that we make choices. Why do we do this? You look at the very basic choices that we make in the day. Why do we get up at one time in the morning rather than another? Why do we choose to do one meditation rather than another one? Why do we choose to this particular piece of food rather than another one? And all of those choices we make during the day, we choose to do things, and we don't really know what it is that we're choosing or why we're doing this one or the other one. But those choices that we make, even though we don't really know why we're making them, those choices determine our life. We reach the fork in the road and we go left or we go right. And from that moment on, everything that happens to us is different. So we've, in a sense, we've created an entirely new world. If we consider the world as being a world of experience, a world as seen from inside, a new world has appeared. So this is why this is the most fundamental thing in our life, is what choices do we decide to make. And this is why I think one of the worst phrases that we can ever use is, I had no choice. You've always got a choice. Doesn't matter what the situation is. So this is what Sartre called bad faith, if you're pretending that you have no choice. But in fact, you're lying to yourself and lying to others about why you're doing what you're doing. We always have a choice. Now this process, this way that we in a sense are creating the world through our choices, When I say creating the world, you have to understand this through, in the Buddhist sense of this, the way that the Buddha used it in contemplation of the six senses, that what we perceive through the six senses is our world. Okay, so this is not the world in an objective sense. I'm talking here purely about the world in a subjective sense. So if I come to the fork of the road and one fork goes to the left and that leads to the mountains, then my world is a world of mountains. And if I take the fork to the right and that leads to the ocean, then my world is a world of ocean. That's the world as I've perceived it, and I've created my own world. Now, it's quite undeniable and quite obvious that our choices do in fact create our world in that kind of sense. This is fairly straightforward. But what the Buddha has said is that this interdependence or connection between our own choices, our own inner reality and the external reality are intertwined and interdependent at a much more fundamental level. In other words, that any choices that we make on a micro level or on a psychological level have some kind of macro or cosmological counterpart. This is a very common idea in ancient philosophy, so there's a correspondence between the individual and the cosmological level. So what one of the basic principles of dependent origination is that just as we are creating our world from moment to moment, we're changing things, we're altering what our experience is, this also has a much wider cosmological implications, and that is that we're creating the world that we're going to be reborn in, that our consciousness will take birth in. So dependent origination is pointing to this, an analogy between the psychological and the cosmological, between the micro and the macro, but it's more than an analogy. It's actually the same thing being played out on a small and a large scale. So just pause here to just reflect for a moment on the implications of this, on what it might mean. If you again come back, look inside yourself, look at this consciousness, this awareness. Who is this that's here? What's going on? And we see the changes in that. We can reflect on, you know, different moods that we have. You can look back earlier in this evening, maybe different moods or feelings that we've had at different times in the evening, or different thoughts. You know, I look back and I sort of think, oh, okay, I did this earlier, and then I had a shower, and then I went to drinks, and then I had a discussion about what we're doing on Saturday, and then thought about what I was going to give the talk about, and got ready for the talk, and so on. So this kind of process of what's been leading up to being here. And this is a kind of process of what, you know, I recognize that this continuity, this flow, is what I am. And it's indefinite. I can keep tracing that flow indefinitely back into the past, just dependent on how good my memory is, and I can again assume that it will go indefinitely into the future, unless of course it's cut off by death or whatever, but it has a continuity to it. And of course one of the great teachings, the great insights of the Buddha was that to understand this and to explain that, we don't have to use the idea of a self. The idea that there's something unchanging which underlies the process. This is unnecessary to explain what it is. It's a superfluous hypothesis. We can explain and understand what's going on by understanding just those things that we're aware of, the things that we can all agree with, that we have contact, we have sense stimulus, we have feelings, we have memories, we have perceptions and intentions and consciousness and all of these things. And this aspect of the Buddha's teachings is much like in 19th century science, when they first realized that light was like a wave, and then they assumed that the wave must have a medium to propagate in, because they knew that waves on the ocean have a medium of water to propagate in, or waves, sound waves, have the medium of air to propagate in, so light must have a medium. And they call this medium ether. And they assumed that it must exist. And then later on, as the knowledge advanced and so on, they realized that actually the theory of ether was not necessary. That light waves were a kind of wave which didn't need a medium to propagate in. So this is something like the theory of a self. The theory of a self is the idea that there's a kind of unchanging entity which underlies what we can see, all the changes. It's like an ether which underlies the, supports the changing light rays and photons. So the Buddha said that that's not a not necessary to do that. It doesn't add anything to the equation. It doesn't help us. So there's just this, what's going on now. Hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching. All the stuff going on in our mind. That's all that there is. That's all there ever has been. That's all there ever will be. So I ask you just to hold that thought, just to reflect in on oneself, reflect in what actually is happening now, and just ask yourself, what would it mean for this interiority which I can directly perceive, what would it mean for this to disappear or to end at the time of death, when you stop breathing, heart stops pumping, blood flow stops to the brain, everything ceases. Is that just going to fade away and cease, like the picture on a television set or a sound from a radio when you switch it off? It's just not going to be there anymore. Or is it going to continue somehow? I'm not asking you to answer that question. I'm asking you to reflect on what that would mean or what that would feel like, if to think of it in those two different ways. So of course, on a simple level, both of those are perfectly, you know, rational, sensible possibilities. You see, in the world there is both change and continuity. Things come and go, but also things continue. We see that in nature all the time. The flowers are born, come up, they grow, they pass away and they die. But they leave the seeds behind, so a new flower comes up, which is pretty much the same as the old one. So nature has both change and continuity. So both of these options, I think, are, you know, they're both perfectly rational, sensible ones. But, and of course there's a, as we all know, there's a kind of a debate and there's a genuine diversity of views about what actually happens. I don't want to talk tonight, I don't want to talk about kind of the evidence for or against rebirth, but I'm more interested to try to reflect on and gain some kind of intuition as to what that may be, what that may feel like, how that kind of the resonance of that. This is something that came to me once, and I remember, because, you know, for many years I was an atheist. I didn't believe in rebirth at all. And it came to me one time. I still remember it very clearly. It was on a Christmas day when I was in Chiang Mai. And I remember I was standing. Suddenly there's just this like opening, or this knowledge, or this intuition. Very kind of knowledge. Maybe it was a false knowledge, I don't know. But this intuition came. It wasn't like a memory of past lives or anything like that, but it was just like a sense of a vastness, or like almost like a wall dropping away and letting me see the depth or the infinity that lay beyond that. Seeing somehow an apprehension of the vastness of this thing that we call consciousness as a flow and as a continuity. So just as we see in our minds all the time, if we're looking, we see how things change, we see how things are conditioned. Senses, the sense activity is stimulated by something, we have a feeling, we grasp at that, we're attracted to pleasant feeling, we're repelled from painful feeling, we remain ignorant about neutral feeling, we go out to grasp that feeling, we form intentions on the basis of that, and those intentions create the kind of state of mind that we're in. They create the world that we live in. And that same process that we observe again and again and again on that ordinary everyday psychological level, that process has much more profundity to it than simply that. It's not just a psychological process. You know, that basic psychological process, in a sense, is trivial. I mean, you can like, you know, program a robot or something to do that. You know, you can program a robot to see something and then react to it and then move towards it and do something about it. It's not too difficult to do that. So that aspect of dependent origination is something that's readily observable. It's not hugely profound, and the insight into that is only at a certain level, and the insight into that doesn't actually lead you very much. It leads to a certain degree of understanding, but not all that far. But the real depth of dependent origination, the real interesting part about it, is seeing how that then plays out on that large scale. So it turns it from a teaching which is just psychological, which is merely about, well, what emotions and thoughts and so on do you have at this time, to being an existential teaching. What is the actual nature of existence itself? Why are we here? What is life about? What can we do about it? What does it mean to be free? And so that understanding of that apprehension of that deeper existential dimension of dependent origination, this comes about gradually through a combination of things, partly through just the contemplation of the dependent origination on an ordinary level happening in our mind, partly through the development of samadhi and the clarifying of our mind, and partly through that kind of existential kind of reflection and investigation, inquiry goes on. And so on. So all of those kind of leading together gradually coalesce or gradually form and deepen the insight into what dependent origination means. And so one of the implications of this whole process is that because our choices and our acts come out of that darkness, that unknowing, that we call avidya. It's not giving a psychological statement and saying we're all stupid and we all do things because we don't know what we're doing. That's not the point of that statement. The point of that statement is to say that there's a profound level at which we don't understand the nature of who we are and what we're doing here. And it's out of that we might act. Even if in a particular case we might be familiar with the facts of a case and make good choices and so on, right? But underneath that, at a deeper level, there's still this very profound unknowing. And as long as that unknowing is informing all of our choices and whatever we're doing, and of course this is what gives rise to suffering. So the ending of that unknowing leads to the ending of suffering. For me, this is the point of dependent origination, leaving aside all of the details of it and so on. And the point of it is that we have a practice which gives us a way of practicing and investigating specific things in our own presently aware consciousness, in our meditation. We can investigate contact and feeling and craving and so on, actually see those things unfolding. This is what, in the suttas, what they call dhamme jnanam, the awareness of dhammas, presently arisen dhammas. But it also leads to what they call anvaya jnanam, the inferential knowledge, which is where the knowledge drops down to a deeper level of realization that, well, this is the nature of things, the dhamma tittata. This is the stable nature of the dhamma. It's always like this. Dhamma niyamata, the natural law of the Dhamma. And so the more that connection between the relatively simple, shallow psychological level of dependent origination and the more profound cosmological or existential level, and the more that connection becomes made and the more our insight becomes deep, and at deeper and deeper levels we can let go of those defilements and find deeper and deeper levels of peace. So this is my little talk for you this evening on dependent origination. Again, trying to keep it as short and simple as possible. I don't know whether I succeeded. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.